This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we welcome back Marxist economist Rick Wolf.
Rick has a new book, Capitalism Hits the Fan. If you want to know what happened and why it happened, listen to Rick Wolf talk about it on this show.
And we'll be speaking with Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman about her new book, Breaking the Sound Barrier.
We're turning the tables on Amy. Instead of her interviewing us, we're interviewing her about her wonderful new book. Stay with us. Well, Heidi, finally a bit of good news on the FBI interrogation front. A significant victory in Washington. What is it?
8 years ago, Michael, at the 2002 anti-war protests, eight demonstrators were taking a break to go to their car in a parking garage. They were dressed in black. The FBI followed them in and interrogated them. But they asked them personal questions, religious, political beliefs. They got it on videotape. And then the authorities denied it ever happened. Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, who we've had on this show, and her partner Carl Massinio from the Partnership for Civil Justice, sued. And while preparing for their trial, which was going to begin at the end of this month, they found D.C. police logs confirming that the FBI intelligence unit had interrogated these activists.
About political and religious beliefs, is that right?
Exactly. And we think that what sparked the suspicion of what were essentially plainclothes FBI agents was the fact that the protesters were wearing all black garb, as you know, that the FBI and the police consistently associate with so-called anarchists. And this was the first of at least four civil cases that had been filed against the district, charging with similar cases where the district has so-called problems with evidence or proof. What's happening is we're hopefully unearthing a pattern of hiding evidence of this kind of police overreaching.
So let me see if I understand this. These people were arrested, and then while they're in their cells, while they're in the police cars, the FBI comes in and asks them a series of questions about their politics?
They weren't actually arrested. They were interrogated in a garage where they were having a food break. They were having like Chinese stir-fry food, and they were wearing black. FBI came, interrogated them, and videotaped them.
What the case it reminds me of is the case in New York, the Kunstler case, that also around that time, Sarah Kunstler and 30 other people were protesting against Carlyle.
Carlyle Group, right.
And when they were put into the prison, the New York City cops came around with a form that asked Sarah all her political beliefs, all those kinds of issues. The Center for Constitutional Rights represented Sarah and others and actually won the case. Again, I think it took place in this period, 2002, 2003.
It was around the same year. I think what's special about this case is that each of the protesters is getting $25,000, and then there will be money for attorney fees and litigation costs. This was purely a free speech issue, and I think that's a very good settlement, despite the fact they weren't abused physically, they weren't incarcerated for days. So it's good news, and I hope that it continues in the rest of these cases.
Yeah, the question always in these is, does it really make any difference to the FBI in the end? And I don't know the answer to that, Heidi. But it is at least, we should bless ourselves for any victory.
And it's a 7-year case, so finally it's settled.
Good. And I know you have some other interesting issues. One about an issue which I've barely heard about, a subpoena to Indie Media. Indie Media, of course, puts out newspapers in many, many cities, has a website with all kinds of independent media. And this subpoena, I think, asked for every single IP address of people who visited the Indie Media sites.
On a certain day.
On a particular day. So this seemed to me unbelievable. If ideas of paranoia and nervousness about the FBI and the Justice Department, this one confirmed everything for me.
Well, this asked for all IP traffic to and from the site on that particular day, and this was Indie Media in Philadelphia, by the way. It asked for the IP addresses, and then it asked for email addresses, physical addresses, registered accounts, social security numbers for Indie Media readers, bank account numbers, all of that stuff. Kevin Bankston, who we've interviewed from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, took the case.
What's interesting about one aspect of Kevin Bankston taking the case is they did this through, I think, a provision of the Patriot Act that allows them to do it with and requires the person who gets the request for information, I think it's called, or subpoena, whatever it is, to not disclose that to anyone.
That's exactly right. And that was part of it. There was a gag order included. And so what happened was Kevin wrote to them. And
wrote to whom?
The Department of Justice, and got a one sentence letter back saying the subpoena had been withdrawn. But Kevin also said that the Electronic Frontier Foundation had been meeting around that time with U.S. attorneys from Tim Morrison's office, who had said in the meetings that they threatened the IP administrator, this is a woman, with possible prosecution for obstruction of justice if she disclosed evidence of the already withdrawn subpoena. And they said it might endanger someone's health or have a human cost. So Kevin then wrote a second letter saying that DOJ should apply for a gag order because he was going to pursue a First Amendment claim.
Good for Kevin.
It was. In an update that we've learned, apparently someone in the Justice Department who knew about the subpoena said that attorney Tim Morrison did not follow department regs that required express authorization of the attorney general for media subpoenas, because media subpoenas are a little trickier than regular ones because of freedom of the press. So if that's true, it means that Eric Holder knew nothing about this, and it could possibly be grounds, we would hope, for an internal investigation.
Not firing of those attorneys. But you know what's interesting about this? Because these letters of asking for information or subpoenas are completely secret, and the people who get them, like in this case Indy Media and the administrators of the site, can't say it to anybody. There's no way to police whether the letters actually come from a low-level Justice Department official, a high level, whether they've been authorized. So the whole system is essentially a closed system where you can't do anything, very much or anything about it.
Right, and we don't know how many of these subpoenas have been given out.
Heidi, we don't usually follow the comings and goings of baseball on this show, but today we're actually going to talk about the intersection of baseball and Israel. Is that possible?
It is, and I'm sad to say it involves the New York Mets.
Our own home team?
Our own home team.
The one we usually counter to the rich Yankees?
The one we usually support, but in this case we're not, because the Mets are allowing the Hebron Fund, a Brooklyn-based nonprofit that supports violent and racist Israeli settlers living in the West Bank, to have a fundraising event at Citi Field on November 21st. The Mets, despite pressure to cancel this, have to this date refused to cancel the dinner. It's a fundraising dinner, despite a letter that 11 U.S. Palestinian and Israeli organizations have sent, showing that by supporting Israeli settlements in Hebron, they're violating international law and the Obama administration's call for a freeze in Israeli settlement construction in the occupied Palestinian territory. In an irony, the Hebron Fund dinner is being held directly above the Jackie Robinson Rotunda at Citi Field. And listeners will know that Jackie Robinson broke the barrier of racial discrimination in baseball, and his legacy is actively promoted by the New York Mets and Major League Baseball. If listeners would like to send a letter to the Mets demanding they cancel this event, they can go to campaigns.adalanewyork, that's ADALAHNY.org. And there's a sample letter that you can submit.
Today, we welcome back Professor Rick Wolf, now retired emeritus from the University of Massachusetts, where he chaired the economics department, and who now teaches at the New School and at the New York Marxist School. He's recently written a wonderful book, Capitalism Hits the Fan, The Global Economic Meltdown and What to Do About It. As you'll hear in this interview, Rick will take us back to 2005 and step by step reveal how policies, economic structures, and the wage-to-profit system led to a global capitalist economic collapse.
Rick, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Rick, you've got the best title for your new economics book that Michael and I have ever heard of, Capitalism Hits the Fan.
And the subtitle is The Global Economic Meltdown and What to Do About It. But I want to highly recommend this wonderful book. Our listeners have heard Rick a number of times on the economic crisis, and it's always our most lively and interesting interviews. And the book is likewise extremely lively and interesting. Michael?
Well, Rick, you followed capitalism, and the book has essays that go back from 2005 up to the present. and you followed it as it was approaching the fan. And our first question to you is, why did it hit the fan? What was the origin of the crisis? Let's talk about that, and then let's talk about what one might do about it.
Well, the origin really goes deep into American history. It's one of the key things that I think people do not adequately understand or want to face.
Your first chapter is called Roots of a Systems Crisis. So I presume that's what you're about to talk about.
Exactly. It's really the roots that go deep into American history and culture and economics. You know, we were a country that was founded by foreigners coming here. They got rid of the indigenous population, which had very different economic system. They established here a kind of mixed system, capitalism on the one hand with employers and employees, and then self-employed farmers and small craftspeople and so on. And in the end, there was a struggle between the farmers and the small craftspeople on the one hand, the capitalists on the other, and let's not forget, in the southern part of the United States, still another economic system, slavery. And when the dust cleared, capitalism defeated the other two. It literally destroyed slavery, and it subordinated all the self-employed people so that they would be small and on the margins of the economic system.
You're talking about my law practice.
That's right.
So you're saying that we should be happy at least with one part of capitalism, destruction of slavery.
Of course.
Perhaps. Depends a little bit on how the capitalism we have evolved. Anyway, what it did was it created a surging capitalism able to thrive because the other two systems had been destroyed. But it was a surging capitalism which for 150 years, roughly 1820 to 1970, was always faced with the growth of capital outrunning the available labor supply. And that was for two reasons. It's not only that there weren't enough people to go to work making profits for capitalists, but it was that if capitalists didn't treat them right, didn't pay them properly, they had an option. They could go west to where there was abundant land because the people who had occupied it were no longer with us, to be polite. And so in order to hold labor, in order to grow, you basically had to raise wages. The phenomenal thing about the American economy for 150 years, 1820, 1970, was that if you look at the statistics, the real wages, that the actual bundle of goods and services a person could buy with an hour of his or her paid labor, kept going up. It produced in the United States this bizarre and strange and unusual notion in the world that we were blessed here, that if you work hard, you will earn more money, that each generation will live better than the generation before, that Americans can have a dream like that, that they can promise their children a better life than they had and deliver on the promise. It produced this sense of being entitled to all of that, guaranteed almost that this will happen if you play by the rules, etc. It drew millions of immigrants from all over the world who looked at their own societies and concluded that would not be available there. It would be available in the United States, warranting the difficulties of making that transition. They made the transition, and they enjoyed the upswing.
Rick Wolf, the author of a new and really important book, Capitalism Hits the Fan, The Global Economic Meltdown and What to Do About It. And so, Rick, you've got us up to 1970. We're all making a fair amount of money. We all have our nice little houses, our cars, whatever else.
Right.
And then I guess you're going to tell us what happened next.
Well, what happened next was that capitalism reminded us, even though Americans didn't want to be reminded, that it is not a guarantee that your wages will go up. It is not a guarantee that if you work hard, you will be rewarded. None of that. That if the conditions change, capitalism changes too. And in particular, capitalists who never wanted to raise wages those 150 years, who only did it because it was a condition for their being successful as capitalists, in the 1970s, conditions changed, and they no longer had to pay higher wages, and so they didn't. The horrible truth that Americans don't want to deal with is, after 150 years of rising real wages, over the last 30 years, that is over a generation now, the real wages in the United States have not anymore gone up. It's a sea change in our culture's history. It happened in the 1970s, quickly now, for four reasons. One, the arrival of the computer that basically substituted machines for people on a mammoth scale in the United States. Number two, the movement of American corporations to other parts of the world to take advantage of cheaper workers there, workers whose wages had not gone up for 150 years and who were increasingly needing and desperate for work and willing to work at low wages. The result was many fewer jobs being created in the United States. At the same time, women, partly because of the women's liberation movement, moved into the paid labor force in the United States in large numbers, as did immigrants coming from other parts of the world for the usual reasons. You put together the fewer jobs and the more people looking, and you have the conditions that allowed capitalists on Main Street, every bit as much as on Wall Street, to stop paying rising wages. And it plunged the American economy into a disaster zone. Basically, it had two parts. For the workers, with the end of rising wages, it was a kind of psychological trauma. Were they all now supposed to give up the American dream? Were they to say to their children, sorry, I can't send you to school, I can't pay for college, I can't help you in a life that you want to start with, etc. I can't finish your education, whatever. And the answer was the American workers were not willing to give up that dream. It had been rooted too deep in them, and so they went to work doing much more work, sending many more people out to work than ever before. Americans today, for example, work 20% more hours per week than their counterparts in places like France, Germany, or Italy. They are exhausted physically. The families are in disarray because the women went out to work, and they were the ones that held the emotional life of American families together. Hence, by the way, the family values politics of the United States for the last 30 years. And finally, when those things weren't enough to allow them to continue to consume more, to have more things, to live the American dream, they went on a borrowing binge, the likes of which no working class in the history of the world has ever done. One simple statistic. When the Great Depression began in 1929, the average level of debt of an American family equaled about a third of its annual income. In 2007, the official beginning of the current collapse, the average level of debt of an American family was 125% of its annual income. There was no parallel to that in Western history or certainly the American society. So the workers, by the time this recession hits, are physically exhausted, familiarly stressed, and with a debt anxiety out of all proportion to anything we had had before. We had reached, if you like, the limits of what our workers could do. At the same time, the last 30 years have been the greatest boom of profitability of American corporations. Just think, the productivity goes up because of the computer and so on. Each worker produces more and more for his or her employer year after year for the last 30 years. But the employers don't pay them any more wages. That's what it means when real wages don't go up anymore. So if the employer is getting more and more from the worker each week, each year, but doesn't have to pay the worker anymore, then the whole benefit of productivity accrues to rising profitability for enterprise. Capitalists went crazy.
Rick Wolf, let me ask you this. You've just written Capitalism Hits the Fan, The Global Economic Meltdown and What to Do About It. What truth is there to the Marxist notion that workers aren't paid enough to buy back what they produce?
It's the classic old problem of capitalism. The capitalist is always torn. On the one hand, the capitalist wants to keep the wages down because, after all, profits are precisely the difference between what the worker produces that the capitalist then can sell versus what the capitalist has to pay the worker for doing so. So the capitalist has an incentive to keep wages low. But the problem is, when it comes time to sell what the worker has produced, the capitalist wants there to be lots of buyers out there. Since the majority of buyers are workers, the more you pay them, the better buyer they can be. And the capitalists have never figured out how to resolve this contradiction, because there is no way to do that. If you're pressing the wages down, as the last 30 years do, you will eventually come to the point where you can't sell the stuff. We only postponed that in America for 30 years by having the workers go on a borrowing binge. As the book points out, if you wonder how the workers were able to borrow, ask yourself the question, where did the money come from to lend to those workers borrowing these unprecedented amounts? And the horrible answer that kind of summarizes the craziness of the American economy that has now collapsed is that the money that was lent to the workers was precisely the boom in profits made possible by their no longer having rising wages.
So what you're saying is that instead of paying rising wages, they simply made more profits and then at an interest rate lent it back to the very workers who were basically at best having the same wages they had before but could no longer buy anything.
And think of this. Imagine yourself in a business school somewhere trying to explain to a young collection of men and women eager to become businessmen and women, this is nirvana. Not only do you get ever more goods and services produced by your workers without having to raise their pay the way it was done for the previous 150 years, but you get to substitute loans to these workers for the higher wages. So you not only get the profitability of a flat wage situation, but you get the added income of the interest that comes from lending to the workers whose wages you're no longer raising.
Rick Wolf, Capitalism Hits the Fan, his new book, The Global Economic Meltdown and What to Do About It. Well, Rick, that was pretty remarkable. Michael?
Capitalism has been responsible for two huge economic disasters in the last 75 years, and it most likely will be responsible for more in the future. What do you, as a socialist, say should be a better system?
Well, I would say two things. The first thing that's so important for people to realize, and by the way, I think the election results underscore what I'm about to say. The traditional ways of handling collapses in capitalism are increasingly ineffective and intolerable for masses of people. This bailing out of the companies that caused the problem, this decision that companies are too big to fail, plus then a policy that is actually making even bigger banks than we had before, therefore even bigger than before and unable to fail, etc., is wearing thin on the population. It's clear that the reforms and regulations put into place after the Great Depression, which Roosevelt and every president since said, promised, were put into place to prevent another breakdown, obviously failed because we're in the middle of another breakdown. So something different, something much more profound has to be done if we don't want to leave as a legacy another breakdown and all the suffering that it costs.
Your last chapter of your book, or your last part three, is called Politics of the Crisis, and you're starting to address that now. I just want to tell our listeners, the three headings I have here are reforms and regulations as crisis solutions, which I presume is what you're going to speak to us now about, then debates over socialist solutions, and finally, anti-capitalist politics. So let's, I guess, go to what you're addressing now, reforms and regulations as crisis solutions.
Right. Basically, I'm arguing that the reforms and regulations we've seen don't work. They never have. If you actually go back and look at the Great Depression, it wasn't the reforms and regulations, as desirable as many of them were, like the WPA and the CCC and the Securities and Exchange Commission and unemployment insurance and Social Security. We may want those things, but they didn't work then to solve the problem. The only thing that got Americans working again after a 10-year depression lasting 29 to 39 was not an economic policy of reform and regulation. It was something called World War II, and that's what put people back to work. The irony is that even those reforms that were put into effect, mostly in the last 50 years, have either been evaded by corporations or weakened or gotten rid of altogether, culminating in George Bush's unsuccessful but not over yet effort to privatize Social Security.
Absolutely right.
In any case, my point is you have to have a different approach. And the different approach is basically this. Every reform and regulation that was passed, as I said, was either evaded, weakened, or gotten rid of. And the way that was done was by corporations in America using their profits to change the political system, to buy politicians, to create an army of lobbyists, to use those profits, particularly in the last 30 years, made possible by workers no longer having wage increases, to get rid of every one of those rules and regulations. Therefore, to have another set of rules and regulations that leave in place the capacity of corporations to do again what we know they've already done is the height of folly. It's a mistake, and it cannot work. And so what has to happen is we have to face the fact, the old socialist argument, that business ought not to be run by a small number of people making profit off the labor of a large number of people and then free to use that profit to prevent any kind of fundamental management of a system in the interests of the majority of the people. And to change that means we have to change enterprises. We have to basically reorganize the production of goods and services so that the groups of people, the workers who do the work and make these things, are their own boards of directors, that we no longer have corporations run by 15 to 20 people on a board of directors who are chosen and responsible to a tiny number of major shareholders who have all the power and who shape the system to meet their needs. And nothing illustrates that better than the collapse their decisions brought us now and the fact that the way out of this collapse seems to be to give them our collective tax money so they can get back on their feet so that, Lord help us, they can do it all again.
Well, then the question becomes, how do you get from where we are to where we want to be?
And the only answer to that, and I wish I could give you more than this, the only answer to that is that you have to take the mass of people in America, make clear to them, as my book tries to do, how we got into this safe situation, and then begin to say, look, the only way out is if you, the mass of people, the majority, demand different responses to this crisis than what you're getting, than a rerun of what has been done in the past that has not worked in the past. And I actually see a glimmer of movement in that direction when the voters just did what they did, and they voted, as most signs indicate, because they're very angry about the economic crisis. They're very disappointed with the Obama government's response to it, and they're beginning to stir and behave in ways that weren't anticipated. And it is my hope that if we get out the message that the book tries to develop, that the political movement will be in the direction of questioning capitalism rather than presuming it's always been there and it always will be.
Rick, we're going to give you a last word here. We're running out of time. I want to announce your book again. Richard D. Wolff is the author, but we call him Rick Wolff. And the book is Capitalism Hits the Fan, The Global Economic Meltdown, and What to Do About It. You can understand how clearly this book is written and how much you'll learn from it, because he's always like incredibly good on our shows at explaining to a simpleton like me how this economy works.
How do people get your book?
You can get the book the cheapest, easiest way is basically to go to my website and click on the icon, the little picture of the cover, and that'll take you automatically to Amazon, where you can get the book at a significant discount from its retail price of $18, which was intentionally cheap in order to make the book available.
What's your website?
My website is www.rdwolff.com. So www.rdwolff.com.
What sort of demands should people be making on this government to get the economy going in a direction that we want it to be in?
Two basic demands that I would put front and center. One, we now have an official unemployment rate over 10%. We have 15 million adults looking for work and unable to find it. We have another 10 million more that are either discouraged and have given up or working part-time when they work full-time. The first thing this government should do is provide work for the unemployed, not go around giving all the money to the banks, not trying to develop coaxing mechanisms to get some companies to hire a few more people. The private sector has failed in the United States, and when that happens, the government should not just be the lender of last resort, the bank bailer-outer of last resort, it should be the employer of last resort, to help most people in the most direct way. And the second thing the government should do is support financially the development of enterprises where workers form them and run them as their own enterprises in a collective way that is different from capitalist corporations, and then let the American people, as workers, choose whether they want to work in an enterprise run by the workers or one run by capitalists, and let us as consumers choose between goods and services produced by workers working in that non-capitalist way alongside the capitalists. We already have people choosing fair-traded goods, choosing goods that are not made by children, and so on. We ought to have a way to let Americans work in and choose to buy the products of enterprises organized in a new and a genuinely democratic way, which is not the capitalist system.
Nor, I think, the Republican or Democratic parties. I think that's the key question. We're going to talk to you about that next time. Rick Wolf, author of Capitalism Hits the Fan, The Global Economic Meltdown, and What to Do About It. Thank you so much, Rick, for being on Law and Disorder.
And as always, thank you for inviting me. I'd love to do it again whenever you're so inclined.
Thank you, Rick.
Good luck with the book.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Pleased to have with us Amy Goodman, the host and executive producer of Democracy Now! And the co-author with her brother of three New York Times bestsellers. And today we're going to talk to Amy about a fourth, hopefully, New York Times bestseller, Breaking the Sound Barrier. Amy, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Michael, and all the folks at Law and Disorder.
Yeah. I want to say, Amy, this book is fabulous. You know, I didn't pick it up until a couple days ago, although I've had it for a week. And every single one of the columns, and they're maybe 750 to 1,000 words each, has an amazing nugget that I didn't know. One of my favorite lines is, in your war chapters, Hillary Clinton is a once and future warrior. I mean, fabulous, Amy.
Well, you know, remember when Clinton was talking to anti-war voters and said, bring them on. I mean, this book is really a chronicle of the last 3 years. And some things we forget, you know, things change, events change, faces, names, people's positions change, and sometimes they don't. We began with that really interesting moment at the United Nations, right around the time Colin Powell was pushing for war there, you know, February 5th, 2003. And this is about the nexus of art and politics. When you have this tapestry at the United Nations in front of the UN the UN Security Council, which is a reproduction of Picasso's famous painting, Guernica, famous anti-war painting, I should say. You know, Guernica, the town in Spain that was bombed by Franco, and the images of the humans, the faces of the people and the animals, their faces in agony. And it really depicts the horror of war. And the UN and the United States certainly understood the irony, where you have this push for war. The backdrop of the press conferences was this anti-war painting, this anti-war tapestry. And so they shrouded it in a blue curtain. Well, we have to rent that shroud every which way. We have to tear it, because that's what journalism is all about. It's going to where the silence is. It's showing the reality. It's showing the photos, the images, because it's not the photos, the images that are offensive, though they certainly are, for example, when it comes to torture, when it comes to people dying. It's the fact, the reality of what it's depicting. And that's what has to change. And people aren't going to change it unless they know what's happening.
What's amazing about the book, Amy, is you have, I think, the most number of columns on the war. But as you said, almost every one of the key issues facing us today, war, climate change, torture, healthcare, media, economic meltdown, etc., are covered in this book. And I think when you read it, you can get a real sense of what the history of this country has been the last 3 years, and then going way back almost to its foundings. Because one of the strengths is that you link past struggles, whether it's Frederick Douglass's struggle for against slavery and Donald Rumsfeld having the house where Frederick Douglass was built as one of his summer homes. So each of these columns, you know, links our struggles in this country, and I think that's one of the great strengths of the book.
Well, that's what we're trying to do, and I want to credit Dennis Moynihan, who's edited every column, and also my colleagues here at Democracy Now! I'm speaking to you from the garret of the firehouse right now, which isn't far from where you are, right at 120 Wall Street. But most of the voices in this book of columns are the people who we interview on Democracy Now!, and also going back in history. Media is ahistoric. It's whites out history. How are young people supposed to figure out what to do when they have no sense of what movements came before, what was done, what are models, what works, what doesn't work? And that story from Rumsfeld's Mount Misery is just astounding, that Frederick Douglass was born on the eastern shore of Maryland. He's enslaved as a youth and a teenager. It doesn't surprise people to know, it shouldn't, that he was a troublesome slave. So he was handed to a slave breaker named Edward Covey. And Edward Covey's property was called Mount Misery. And there, Frederick Douglass was tortured. He was beaten. He escaped. He headed north. And very interestingly, he started the North Star newspaper. He came here to New York, and not far from either of us, where BAI is, where Democracy Now! Is an old coffee shop on Church Street that says, has a plaque outside. It's a historic building. It says, David Ruggles, born a free black man in Connecticut, had a printing press here. And when Frederick Douglass came north, he took refuge in this building where there was a printing press. And I think it's so interesting, from David Ruggles to Frederick Douglass, that they saw media, they saw newspapers, they saw printing press as their means of liberation. That's how come the media is so important. So back to Mount Misery, where he was tortured. Frederick Douglass was tortured and was beaten. Well, in 2003, Donald Rumsfeld bought Mount Misery. You got it. It's now owned by Donald Rumsfeld, then the defense secretary, to be near his close friend, Vice President Dick Cheney. And I just couldn't believe the story that Donald Rumsfeld, you know, has the current day Mount Misery. So I went down with Dennis Moynihan to St. Michael's, Maryland, to see, could this possibly be true? This was at the height of the war when he was defense secretary. Could he actually own Mount Misery? And we went to this organic coffee shop. Coffee is a theme in my life, as you could see. I thought, well, where am I going to find out where he lives? And I went in and they said, what would you like? I said, I'd like to know where Donald Rumsfeld lives. And they said, oh, you just go out back and you go down. Well, they said, there's Mount Pleasant Road. Don't go down Mount Pleasant Road. You make the next turn on Mount Misery. And that's just what we did. Drove down to the end of the road. And there we saw the Secret Service. I got out, started filming, thinking, does Donald Rumsfeld know the significance of this property? But sure enough, he passes it every day because there is a stake in the ground that says Mount Misery. It is so important for us to understand the history and to know what people coming out of misery, what people have accomplished, like the greatest abolitionist of all time, and that is Frederick Douglass.
Amy, it's Michael Smith here, breaking the sound barrier. Hello. We're really very happy to have you on the show. You remember you interviewed Michael and I. You interview Michael all the time, unfortunately, about torture, but you interviewed the two of us a dozen years ago when we had done a book on the FBI secret papers on Che Guevara. And so now we've turned the table on you, and we're very glad to talk about your book, Breaking the Sound Barrier. It just came out. It's a really fine book. I think the reason I like it the most is that when I listen to your program, which I do every morning, to get your own personal ideas, you really have to go between the lines in your interviews. But this book is your personal ideas, ideas written with a historical understanding, like you've just explained. You interview Studs Terkel, one of our favorite people. You cite Gore Vidal saying this is the United States of amnesia. And Studs Terkel says, I think it's the United States of Alzheimer's. And and you're that historic memory. And this book, Breaking the Sound Barrier, encompasses that. And I think that's what's so important about the kind of journalism you do. And I would recommend this book to our listeners, Breaking the Sound Barrier, just a wonderful book. Just to go over some of the chapters, I think it's important to point out that the first chapter is your chapter on war, because that's the central question. But climate change, torture, healthcare, global economic meltdown, media, elections, grassroots activism, luminaries, chapter on Obama. And my question to you, Amy, is this. I read the chapter on Obama, and it seemed to me that you had kind of an ambiguous take on the whole thing. On the one hand, it's great to see a black man living in a house that slaves built, and you make that point. On the other hand, you talk about the finances of the Democratic Party and how about they destroyed the public funding of elections, that Obama spent over $2 billion on the election, and that the people with all that money to give to him, you can give up to $65,000 a piece. And it's those people and those interests that have the access and the influence. And my question is, we've had a year now since Obama took office. What's your take on it now? Are you encouraged, disappointed, somewhere in between, particularly with respect to the war question?
I mean, as you said, Michael, the war is central. And you have now President Obama making his announcement, and it's, you know, quite expected that he will be calling for, what, something like more than 30,000, I'm sure it'll be more than that, soldiers going to Afghanistan, a surge, as they say, in Afghanistan. And this announcement will come right about the time that President Obama is heading off to Oslo to win the Nobel Peace Prize. And I might add that, you know, he's going to be in Oslo, and the Copenhagen talks are taking place at about the same time, the climate change talks, the talks to deal with this looming and, in fact, occurring right now crisis of our day, global warming. President Obama went to Copenhagen recently, right, to push for, to lobby for his hometown, Chicago, to get the Olympics. Will he be going to Copenhagen for what Bill McKibben, great environmentalist, founder of 350.org, has called perhaps the greatest diplomatic summit of all time? Will he be going? I mean, the significance of President Obama, who's actually even more popular in Europe than he is in the United States, in some places like at 90% or more, the significance of this world leader showing up to say this is important is a very serious question. That's global warming. And then the issue of global warming. Afghanistan, the fact that this surge will be announced. Today on Democracy Now! We had Denis Kucinich speaking to us from his hometown of Cleveland. He voted against, by the way, the health care bill. And very interesting to hear his take. Sure, he was an opponent of Obama when they were both running for president in the Democratic Party for the nomination. But he says you look at, in every area, what is happening. The money shifting from those who least have it to those who most have it and continue to concentrate it. Whether we're talking talking about the economic meltdown, Obama surrounding himself by the Goldman Sachs folks, and, you know, the bankers who now can most afford it, getting the money from those who least can, to the war. We're obsessed with the debt when it comes to providing health care for people in this country. But what about when it comes to war? All of these issues are key. But I do think that now that the community organizer in chief has become the commander in chief, that model of community organizing has to be adopted by people all over this country. There's something very important that now parents are going to be saying to their kids, maybe you can be a community organizer too. You know, that's a really good thing. But people have to flex their muscle on all of these issues. It's not going to happen because there's one person in the White House. It's not only that he can't do it alone, but he often completely shifts his position because of those he surrounds himself by. But, you know, when those who most have access to the White House and walking the West Wing, those with power and money who are used to doing this, whisper in the commander-in-chief's ear as he's sitting in the Oval Office, if he can't point outside and say, if I do that, they will storm the Bastille. If there's no one out there that he's pointing out, we're all in very big trouble. Sometimes it's going to be he needs support to do what he was elected for, what he promised that change was all about. But a lot of times it's going to be things he doesn't want to do, but that people who organized, who elected him do. And now they have to organize around this country. And we need a media that reflects and amplifies and provides a sounding board and an area of debate and discussion for these grassroots movements.
Amy, your chapter on grassroots activism has about a half a dozen or ten, eight or nine essays, all of which are quite wonderful. And one of them, you know, when you talk about grassroots activism, you discuss in there in a number of the essays, Obama's military is spying on U.S. peace groups, and you give us some sense of that. How big of an issue is that? I know you were at the Republican National Convention. I think you talk about that in there as well. I mean, what do you see happening to the issue of dissent in this country?
I think it's very serious. This is a piece I did just recently in July, and it was based on interviews we did on Democracy Now! And by the way, Breaking the Sound Barrier is the name of the column that I do every week. And the column appears in more than 100 newspapers around the country, and anyone can ask their local or national newspaper to run the column. And the idea of it is just like with Pacifica Radio, with WBAI. It's to provide a roadmap for people who pick up a mainstream newspaper, those that haven't folded yet, and can see that there is this other universe of independent media, and it provides a roadmap to point back to these places like Pacifica Radio. And I think that's absolutely critical because I think the issues that we deal with, and spying is a perfect example, cut across the political spectrum. Conservative Republicans like progressives, Democrats, independents, Greens, care about privacy, care about corporate control, care about spying. This was a chilling story. And the reason we called it Obama's military is spying on U.S. peace groups is this isn't Bush's military. We are now in the age of Obama. An anti-war activist in Olympia, Washington, came on Democracy Now! Exposing U.S. Army spying and infiltration of their groups, as well as intelligence gathering by the U.S. Air Force, the Federal Capitol Police in D.C., and the Coast Guard. The infiltration should be, it appears to be, in direct violation of the Posse Comitatus Act, preventing U.S. military deployment for domestic law enforcement, and should strengthen congressional demands for a full-scale investigation of U.S. intelligence activities. You know, going back to the Church Committee hearings of the 1970s, Frank Church of Iowa, we interviewed his wife when we were in Iowa, really cracking down on this issue of spying. But this was chilling, what has happened over the last years, right up until now, in Olympia, Washington. We interviewed Brendan Maslauskas Dunn, who asked the city of Olympia for documents or emails about communications between the Olympia police and the military relating to anarchist Students for a Democratic Society or the Industrial Workers of the World. That was Dunn's union. Dunn received hundreds of documents. One email contained reference to a John J. Towery II, who activists discovered was the same person as their fellow activist, John Jacob. So Dunn told me on Democracy Now!, John Jacob was actually a close friend of mine, so this week has been pretty difficult for me. He said he was an anarchist. He was really interested in SDS. He got involved with Port Militarization Resistance, PMR, with Iraq Vents Against the War. He was a kind person. He was a generous person. So it was really just a shock for me. That's what Brendan said. Jacob told the activists he was a civilian employed at Fort Lewis Army Base and would share information about base activities which could help PMR organize rallies and protests against public ports being sued for troop and Stryker military vehicle deployment to Iraq and Afghanistan. Since 2006, these anti-war activists in Olympia have engaged in civil disobedience, blocking access to the port. I mean, it is truly incredible that what he learned, Brendan, when he just asked for documents to see, you know, how the military was dealing with their protests, he realizes, he finds out that there is a spy among them, at least one, not a civilian spy even, but a spy from Fort Lewis. The military is supposed to be barred from deploying on U.S. soil or from spying on citizens. So then we interviewed Christopher Pyle, who's now a professor of politics at Mount Holyoke. He was a military intelligence officer for years. He said in the 1960s, Army intelligence had 1,500 plainclothes agents watching every demonstration of 20 people or more. They had a giant warehouse in Baltimore full of information on the law-abiding activities of American citizens, mainly protest politics. Pyle later investigated the spying for two congressional committees. As a result of those investigations, the entire U.S. Army Intelligence Command was abolished and all of its files were burned. Then the Senate Intelligence Committee wrote the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, that's FISA of 1978, to stop the warrantless surveillance of electronic communications. And yet here you have this latest situation where you have, and this is just one group that happened to find out that they were being spied on. And let's not forget President Obama's stance on this. When he was senator, he said he would not only not support retroactive immunity for telecoms like, you know, AT&T and Verizon that spied on American citizens, he would filibuster any such move, any kind of immunity being granted them. But when it came time, when we were moving into the Democratic convention last summer, before he was elected, he reversed his position. Not only didn't he support a filibuster, he voted with the Republicans and other Democrats in giving retroactive immunity to the companies that were working with the U.S. government and spying on the American people. I think it is very important that activists, that people across this country who consider them activists or not, hold their leaders accountable. We're talking about the very fabric of this country that people across the political spectrum care about. And it's the right of people to conduct their lives without being spied on and infiltrated.
We're speaking with Amy Goodman, author of the just published book, Breaking the Sound Barrier. It's a resource for the movement. Amy's book is kind of the historical memory of where we've been and gives you an idea of what we have to do. For that reason, it belongs on everybody's bookshelf. Amy, let me ask you this. I see that the book is dedicated to your mother, Dory. What influence did she have on your developing your political understanding and your historical understanding? And what generally were the influence that got you to the point where you're doing the kind of work you're doing now?
Well, I really appreciate that question. I want to give a big shout out to and thank all the listeners who were so kind and being there for me and my family. My mother died of cancer a month ago on October 5th, and my brothers and I spent the last month staying with her, living with her at the hospital. She was up at Mount Sinai. And she was a remarkable woman, as was my dad, who died 10 years ago. They were peace activists. They were, active in their community where we grew up on Long Island and Bayshore, just deeply cared about the community. My mom taught women's history and literature at local colleges like Delphi and Dowling and Suffolk Community College. Taught folks who were trying to get more credit so they could increase their salaries, whether they were cops or firefighters or truckers. You know, often it would be men who were thinking they were going to get an easy course here and get some credits, you know, women's literature, chick lit. And they come in, and my mom's introducing them to Toni Morrison and Virginia Woolf. And, you know, soon they're bringing their wives. This is at the time of the height of the women's movement. And they're saying, oh, I understand now what she is looking for. They're bringing their daughters. The classes would pack out, like triple in size by the end. My mother deeply loved literature, was incredibly curious, was a world traveler, an intrepid adventurer. From Israel and Palestine, most recently, to Iran, to Vietnam, to Turkey, to South Africa. She traveled the world. After my father died, she traveled even more. And it was that intense interest. You know, she was a regular, as Vic Skolnick and Charlotte Skye will tell you, at the Huntington Community Cinema, the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington, that wonderful oasis of independent film in Long Island. She just was a regular. She loved documentaries and films and deeply cared about people making the world a better place. And that's really what she instilled in not only me and my brother. She deeply valued her friends. They were her family, too. Out in Stony Brook, where my parents moved after we grew up, they were committed to continuing education for older folks, where, you know, like 1,000 people are involved in lifelong learning there. And it's that total commitment to lifelong education, activism, being on this earth to make it better. That's what
that's a good, sad way, but an important lesson from your mom. We have only a few seconds left, and we want to thank you again, Amy Goodman, author of a recent book, Breaking the Sound Barrier. Thank you for being with us, Amy.
Thanks, Amy. Thanks very much.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.